But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belfry.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello, and welcome to The Advice Show. This week, we're bringing our Meet the Advice CIO series onto the airwaves. I'm glad to be joined by Will Gaffin, Head of Investment at Wise Investments, the asset management arm of Chipping Norton advice firm Wise. We'll talk about Will's background, current tactical bets, and the best and worst investment calls of his professional career. Will, thank you for coming in to the CY Studios. Would you mind introducing Wise and telling us a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So Wise Investment was founded by Tony Yarrow in the 90s and has had a long storied history since then. It spun out two businesses called Evenload and Wise Funds, who are located very near to us. And now we are separate, and we manage about 420 million AUM, assets under sort of advice and management. We invest a full range of asset classes on behalf of clients, managing their full portfolio. But I think the real value that we provide is actually not from myself, but rather from the financial planners, the ones who go out there, sit down, you know, like this, chatting with our clients, sorting out their financial affairs, preparing them for everything from buying a house to retiring and making sure their financial affairs are in order. And then based on that, they and the sort of risk tolerance of those clients, they hand the investments over to myself and my team to manage as best we can.
Well, I'm sure they'll be glad to hear you say that.
Yeah.
You yourself, you started as head of investment at quite young age. How was that?
Yeah, so I started out post-uni. I started as an equity analyst and then moved into being an assistant fund manager and a full fund manager on a range of global equity funds at Lion Trust, and particularly focused on technology. So there's a global technology fund at Lion Trust, a great fund. But I always felt that I wanted to be slightly closer to the end client. And I also felt I wanted a broader scope of investing. So equities are great. The majority of portfolios that we manage are equity. But, you know, it's important to have a holistic view, adding fixed income bonds, you know, property, et cetera, to make holistic portfolios. And I wanted a more direct contact with the end consumer. So the end client, really understand them and invest on their behalf.
What are your kind of tactical bets?
Yeah, so we got a few, and it sort of depends on the risk tolerance of the portfolio. But we've been quite big on the UK for a while, so most IFAs, I have to make sure I don't sound like I'm contradicting myself, so most IFAs do have a good UK equity allocation, you know, a good sort of 20-odd%, which I think as a default is too much. You should be global first. There's a bunch of reasons I can get into as to why you shouldn't over index towards the UK just by default. But on a tactical view, you can say, actually, you know what, this market is undervalued. And the UK market, in our opinion, is undervalued. And there's certainly parts in small cap and in sort of deep value parts of the UK that I think are tremendous, offer tremendous return right now. So we've had an over allocation there. We've had a decent allocation towards emerging markets for the sort of more risky portfolios that can take on the volatility that produces. And in terms of sectors, we like healthcare, but as I say, healthcare has not liked us recently. It's been a tough, tough position to hold, but there's good reason to believe it'll be a good one longer term. And obviously, that's the equity side and fixed income. We've been big fans of ABS, so that's asset-backed securities, which I think are sort of structurally underbought and underappreciated, and offer really, really compelling risk-adjusted return.
Could you talk a bit more about those, actually?
Yeah,
are they something that are kind of more broadly used in the kind of advice investment world? Or?
Yeah, they're rare. People tend to sort of, when it comes to bonds, people tend to stick to government bonds, so tends to be gilts in this country, mm-hmm. And corporate bonds. Mm-hmm. Whereas we see real value in asset-backed securities. So these are commercial mortgages, they're residential mortgages. They can be anything from airplane loans as well. You know, it can be all sorts of car loans. But the core idea is that these are securities backed by tangible assets, and so not just a company's cash flows, but the actual assets that might be owned by a company, might be owned by a consumer. Now, those familiar with, you know, The Big Short, mm-hmm. and the financial crisis and things might be having sort of alarm bells going in their head. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. So, but I think it's worth bearing in mind, the issue with ABSs was really much amplified by the synthetic stuff around it. So people mm-hmm. taking mm-hmm. bets on asset-backed vehicles. And that behavior was really much more aggressive in the States. In Europe, where we focus, UK, Europe, where we focus our attention on ABSs, the regulatory environment was pretty good. They actually only suffered minimal losses through the financial crisis period in terms of the actual principal. And in the wake of the financial crisis, they have been incredibly heavily regulated. So, mm-hmm. for example, banks who issue these ABSs, it used to be that you just wanted to go out and issue as many mortgages as you want. If you've seen The Big Short, you'll know what I'm talking mm-hmm. about. You know, they go and issue mortgages to people who have no job, no income. Because they just want to get the fees, and they bundle it, and the agency ticks a box, and they mm-hmm. sell it. And so they don't have any liability that sort of comes back at them. That's not the case anymore. If a bank issues an ABS, particularly in Europe, they have to hold the riskiest, the sort of equity tranche, it's called, of that ABS vehicle, mm-hmm. Which obviously incentivizes much more prudent behavior. mm-hmm. So that, along with a lot of other regulatory things. So, for example, banks can't count ABSs towards parts of their tier allocation for capital. So post-Basel, banks have to hold a certain amount in certain types of securities. Mm-hmm. ABSs are not treated very favorably there. So they tend to eschew them.
Okay.
Similar with insurers. So the big buyers of bonds in the market tend to be, you know, banks, insurers, mm-hmm. pension funds. And they're sort of regulated out of it, they're disincentivized to buy it, which pushes up yields, makes it very generous.
Okay.
And so you've got these fantastic vehicles that are backed by, you know, real tangible assets, very sensible loans, and are structurally underbought, which just makes them very attractive, I think. Mm-hmm. And sorry, just to add one more thing, they're very low duration.
Okay.
So they tend to be on a floating rate. These loans tend to be made on a floating rate. So we're not taking huge bets on the yield curve. We're just taking a very sensible bet on the credit quality of these mm-hmm. ABSs. Mm-hmm.
How do you get access to them? Are they sold directly from banks or packaged into funds?
That's a great question. So there's only a few fund houses that do ABS funds. Mm-hmm. That's definitely the best way to get it. You shouldn't be going on and buying. Certainly as a retail investor, you're not going to be able to buy ABSs mm-hmm. on the market. You need to go via a fund manager. And there's a few that do it very well. 24 have the Monument Fund and the ABS Opportunities Fund. That's the ones we've tended to stick to. But also M&G do a good ABS fund. Aegon also do great ABS funds.
Yeah. And how do they kind of correlate to the rest of a fixed income, more traditional fixed income?
Yeah,
portfolio?
They do something that looks quite different. They're very steady. If you look at the graph, you have to not be lured into believing that they're just perfect, steady up and to the right. Like they do dip, and you will see if you chart these things, a few wobbles along the way. This is really when credit spreads widen. Mm. The thing you have to always bear in mind is that for the sort of riskier ABS funds, we're looking at sort of a 20% loss in principal before you start getting your principal lost. Mm-hmm. And in the really sort of safer ones, the less risky ones, like the Monument Fund, for example, you're seeing more like 50% principal losses. So you're basically saying the housing market is going to have to halve. And that's Armageddon. I think you've got more things to worry about at that point than your brokerage account. So I think these things are pretty safe, and there's no sort of synthetic naughtiness going on.
Right.
It's a very good regulatory environment. Uh-huh. And yeah, those funds are great, I think. And yeah, how do they differ from just regular bonds? That low duration means that they're just less volatile.
Mm-hmm.
It's really when credit spreads widen that you'll see a bit of a dip. That's sort of pricing in the slight possibility that you're approaching those mm-hmm. principal loss levels.
Yeah. Interesting. Thanks. I guess, as you say, that's something that maybe isn't as commonly invested in.
Yeah,
people in your world. So I want to talk about slept on, sectors more broadly.
Sure.
You mentioned healthcare before.
Yeah.
Could you briefly make the case for healthcare
and
maybe explain a little bit about how it hasn't quite worked out for you yet?
Yes, no, that's a good point. Not yet. So I think you zoom back, healthcare was just beneath tech in terms of high performing sectors for a long time. And it just has structural benefits. So it has a structural growth. You've got demographics, so people getting older, people needing more healthcare for longer. You've also got a sort of a trend of emerging markets, more people becoming more wealthy. And one of the first things they'll spend money on is their own health.
Mm.
So you've got these sort of steady tailwinds behind you. And then structurally within healthcare, it's just a very high quality sector. Yeah, you've got lots of companies with large margins, great IP, very defensible, very moaty.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these things make for a very attractive sector. It's sort of similar to the technology sector, just not quite as racy.
Mm-hmm.
And what we saw is this sector got bid up massively in COVID
mm-hmm.
for obvious reasons. Everyone started spending tons of money on any kind of healthcare equipment. And pharma and everything just got bid up. And then post-COVID, there was a sort of crash where suddenly we've overstocked all our inventory and we're not doing as many of these sort of projects in terms of biotech, for example, as we thought we would be. And the demand for growth sort of slowed and the healthcare sector had a rough time. And then it just seems to have had a series of difficulties are thrown in its way. So every time it sort of catches a break, something else happens. So unfortunately, obviously, there was the killing of the United mm-hmm. Healthcare CEO. That, I think, exposed a huge net amount of negative sentiment towards the sort of healthcare industry in the US, particularly with the insurers. That's had a very negative push on markets. You've also just had RFK come in Trump's cabinet to do healthcare. He's obviously quite skeptical about a lot of things.
Yeah.
I think his attention, thankfully, is more on food
mm-hmm.
Than really hammering pharma. But there's an expectation now that the sort of pharma pipeline is going to start to shift.
Right.
But I think generally, it's just an overly beaten up sector. I think there are fantastic companies within that. And we've got a couple of managers who I think are very well placed to take advantage of when healthcare comes back. And in terms of valuations, they're at near-term lows, mm-hmm. Historic lows.
One particular fund, actively managed fund, that's come under a bit of attention lately is Terry Smith's Fundsmith Equity. So it's a star active manager, very popular with retail investors. It's once the largest fund in the country, but times have been a bit more difficult lately. Over 4 billion pulled in the last 12 months and lagging performance. It's not a very rosy picture. Are you still an investor?
We are still an investor. We had to be very careful though. We, like I said, when it comes to global equities, we tend to veer passive mm-hmm. and we have been veering more and more passive in terms of making sure we are very disciplined about keeping that core. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a child in a sweet shop. It's very, there's a huge urge to do more and more things and stuff more and more things into portfolio, but you really do need to be disciplined and make sure that you're mm-hmm. not eroding that core driver. And yeah, taking a position in Fundsmith is taking a position in a very particular way of investing, which is that sort of quality compounder investing,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a fantastic way of investing. And full disclosure, I certainly when I was an analyst, I owe a huge amount to Terry in terms of my financial education, mm-hmm. in my education about equities, how to invest, particularly with that quality style. And whenever I have someone that asks me about the financial industry, someone in uni, someone even in school who says they're interested in investing, the first thing I'll always give them to read will be Terry Smith's shareholder letters, because I think they're a fantastic tool to learn. I think that, you know, he has that skill that top investors have, which is to be able to condense complicated ideas down to very simple language that works no matter, you know, if you're a veteran or just coming into the industry for the first time. There's always real sort of cherries in there. So I always read those letters. I always watch the shareholder conference and see what he's got to say about markets. I mean, in terms of his recent performance, yeah, it's been tough. I think I mentioned Evenode earlier. They who spun out of Wise Investment, they have a sort of similar quality compounder approach. I'm sure neither of them will appreciate me making those comparisons, I think that it's fair to say that there is some similarity there. And there's other sort of quality investors, the likes of Lindsay Train as well. They've all had a really tough patch. I think post-financial crisis through to 2020, these guys were outperforming by yards. And that style of investing made a great deal of sense. I think some of those names probably got overbid up. And then other trends took over, particularly, you know, people talked to death about a Mag 7. I'm almost sorry I've had to mention it now. But on the one side, they've got sort of on the rich valuation side, they've got these sort of Mag 7 that they tend to eschew for good reason. It's not within their sort of wheelhouse. And then on the other side, they've got these sort of deep value plays like things like banks. People don't realize banks have doubled, some tripled over the last year. If you're a quality investor, you tend not to own banks. You tend not to own sort of hype AI names. You're probably not going to have Nvidia, although there might be good reason to. And therefore, you've missed out on the sort of real drivers of the market recently. And then you throw in a few difficult bits in there. So Novo Nordisk having had a massive drawdown. I think that the issue with that style of investing is that you've got to just be very careful not to overrun. And the problem is that it's very difficult to learn that lesson because sometimes you make a mistake of omission. So you hold these great companies, and if you sell them too soon, they can easily keep compounding away and you're just like, oh, what have I done? But similarly, you've got to be able to dispense with these old friends when their valuations are too rich, when the story's starting to turn, when things start to go wrong. Otherwise, you get this sort of double whammy of slowing growth and the valuation reset. And you know, the valuation, if you're 40, it can easily halve and then some.
I suppose, with that, what's kind of true at the level of a stock is true at the level of a fund as well. And I mean, as you say, people like Nick Train as well, you know, have been stars for a long time, but those stars are starting to wane a bit. Do you think there's still a place for that kind of sector agnostic, global, active investor who, you know, swears they can beat the market? Is that still possible?
Yeah, it's definitely possible. It's just really difficult. And then I sort of describe it as trying to look in a crystal ball to see who can look in a crystal ball. I'm having to decide who can beat the market, you know.
That's the job of the MPS allocator,
And I think it's therefore easier to take easier to back yourself to sort of not beat the market, but make value calls in different sectors. So you have the ability to almost come out the box and make calls around that than be stuck in a game, but that can be very punishing at times. Like if you haven't owned Nvidia, you've had a really tough time. And most, you know, UK managers, global managers haven't owned Nvidia. Now, there are exceptions. So for example, I think the Ranmore Global Equity Fund, I keep seeing that they've done a tremendous job, and they don't own Mag 7. They've done tremendous things without that. So there is a way to outperform for these global equity managers. It's just very hard to predict how and when. Right. And if you're doing this on a tactical basis, that does matter. That said, I think there is a perfectly good place to just be a very long-term investor in that sort of quality strategy. So you can just say, look, if I can stomach some underperformance that can go on for 3-5 years, but long-term, I really believe that quality investing can outperform, and there's good evidence that it can, then by all means, back these guys.
And that process of looking through a crystal ball to look at a crystal ball, must take a lot of reading, a lot of fund manager meetings, a lot of events. What's your kind of process when you're going doing that kind of fund selection process, or just kind of getting to know different sectors, different geographies? What do you read? What do you look for?
Well, there's no shortage of material because fund managers will be very keen for you to read their latest blog, their latest update. And obviously you guys do a great job of keeping on top of all that stuff.
You're very kind.
So actually it's more about how do you sort of filter out, you know, the noise. And we're blessed, you know, with Wise Investments out in near Chipping Norton, out in the Oxfordshire countryside, beautiful countryside. So it's a very quiet place. Fund managers really have to be very determined to come out and visit us. It's not just a 10-minute tube down to our door. And so that perhaps helps filter out some noise. How do you do it? We tend to do it on a project-by-project basis. So we say, right, we see some interesting stuff happening in Japan right now. We have various ways that we judge value within markets. And if something comes up on a sector or geography, we look into it. So I gave Japan as an example there. We would then say, right, let's screen all the funds in Japan and see which ones are doing the kinds of things that we think are well set up to outperform in the future. So it's not just a performance goal, but part of it is, you know, have they outperformed in times that we believe are coming, similar times to what we believe is coming. So for example, if you think that growth in Japan, exporters in Japan are about to really knock it out of the park, or actually small domestic players are the better play. Like you find the manager within that has that discipline and has shown that they can outperform. I think it's easier to outperform on a sort of smaller market when you're a real specialist, particularly in places like emerging markets, UK, Japan. As part of that project, we then get a short list of funds. We have meetings with them. And actually, part of that meeting isn't just to assess the fund, but it's also to see if they're seeing what we're seeing. Have we missed something? You know, these are the experts. Mm-hmm. And fund managers, generally speaking, they will be bullish about their market. You know, they're not immune to being sales guys as well. But you will also get a sense for, right, is this a market that's now trading at a very interesting place or poised for immense growth? And then we use all that information and we say, right, this is a tactical call we want to make. This is the fund, maybe a spare fund as well, if for whatever reason it's not on a platform that a client is on.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we're going to approach it. And we're very careful. So in terms of not taking too many tactical bets, we, for example, have a minimum position size of 5%, which I think, again, helps stop that kid in a sweet shop situation. It means that we have to have decent conviction when we say, right, let's do this.
That 5% idea, where did that come from?
Maybe it's just my love of round numbers, but it's sort of a right call. I mean, when I first came to Wise, we even had a 10 position cap, which for a lot of MPS providers, like, oh, that's very few positions.
Yeah.
But again, if you have that passive equity core, that's one position that dominates a large chunk of your portfolio. So, and if you're only making a few tactical bets around that, then you don't need that many positions. Mm-hmm. We have expanded that. We're now sort of, we cap it at 15, but we're still quite disciplined about, 5%. That's what you need to have conviction. Because I think we're not fund managers in that when you're a fund manager, you need diversification through having, say, 30 plus positions. The underlying funds do a lot of the diversification for you. So you're just trying to make sure that you're having the right sort of factor, geographic sector exposures. Mm-hmm. You don't need to worry about having enough positions. The fund managers kind of take care of that for you.
Right.
And if you own a global equity passive index fund, like you've already got thousands of positions within that. You don't need to worry. So I think, you can be doing too much.
On that point of risk, what comes with risk is upside and it's downside. And so it's that time. The best and worst investment calls of your life. let's start with the best.
I'm actually very nervous to say this because I don't want to spark a debate. I certainly don't want to be painted in a certain picture. But when I graduated, I took a summer out to do some work, some interning work. And I looked at financial markets and I looked at a particular asset class that was fairly unknown at the time, known as cryptocurrency. And I took a view then. It was probably my stupidest investment and unfortunately has been my best investment to purchase some. And It often makes me feel like a huge hypocrite when I then turn around to people and be like, you know, you should be very careful about cryptocurrencies. And you absolutely should be. You absolutely should be careful about cryptocurrencies. It is an industry rife with scams and issues. I think there is potentially some value there as a store of value. I don't want to kick off a whole line of debate about that. But unfortunately, that probably is just on an absolute basis in terms of percentage return, my best call.
How well is it done? Could you give a ballpark? How long ago was it?
This is 2016.
Okay. Okay.
So yeah, we're talking when Bitcoin was say 500-600, Ethereum was like 10-11.
Right. Yeah. And where are we now? It's slightly below.
It touched all-time highs earlier this week at $122, I think, $1,000.
Gosh.
So yeah, crazy yeah. return.
So might we see cryptocurrencies in Wise portfolios?
Yeah, yeah. So interestingly, I had a seminar the other day, and I gave a tour of how we invest. Yeah, you know, talk about some of the things that we talked about, and talked about all the asset classes. I did not talk about cryptocurrency, and half the questions we then had were on cryptocurrency.
Right.
And should I buy some? How much? And my advice. If you have to buy some, if you're really compelled, and it's difficult to watch an asset class do what that has done, because everyone will have probably heard it around 2016, 2017, 2018, you've probably heard, oh, Bitcoin's a thing, but it's silly, it's for these sort of crazy nut jobs online. And then you sort of wake up in 2021 or now in 2025 and you see what it's done and you go, oh, I missed it. Like, I can't miss it again. And so that FOMO, that feeling of FOMO is very powerful. And so I say, look, just don't put more than say 1% of your of your net worth into this, and be prepared for it to, you know, to halve. And yeah, there's an incredibly volatile thing with dubious value behind it. But I'm a massive hypocrite because I still hold some. So
yeah, but as you say, for some people that's the best decision.
Yes,
for others it's the worst. I mean, it depends.
It's a really difficult debate. It's certainly not something that we will put in our models. It's not something, this can change. So, you know, disclaimer, this could change. But certainly right now, it's not something we're planning on putting in our models. Our financial planners are very good at chatting to clients. We are not perma bears when it comes to cryptocurrencies. Those that hold it have their reasons. There's good reasons to hold it. If you, for example, have a really dim view on fiat currencies and you think gold is a bit bleh, then that's probably a perfectly good argument as to why to hold some Bitcoin and potentially other currencies. But I think once you stray away from the main ones, you stray into into shaky ground.
Yeah.
And I think it's also worth pointing out that there's other ways of having exposure to it. So, for example, when we buy a global equity index, we're buying some Coinbase. You know, that's the largest broker in cryptocurrencies. We're buying other crypto adjacent companies as well. NVIDIA, you know, chips still are used for a lot of crypto mining. So you're buying a company that has exposure there. I mean, now a very small percentage of their business, but still, you don't need to have direct cryptocurrency in your wallet. And it can be quite dangerous to have quite a lot in your wallet to get exposure to that asset class. Mm.
So that's the best.
That's the best. Unfortunately, I wish I could talk about something else. I've made some good stock decisions in my time too.
I'm sure. Next time you're in, we'll go.
Yeah, I can wax lyrical about Constellation Software, for example. I've had in my ISA for a long time, and that's been a fantastic investment. I've made a few bad investments. I've held Disney for far too long.
Right. Well, that brings us on to the
worst investments. So in professionally, the healthcare sector call that we made a year and a bit ago, that's been a tough one. That's right. Not performed well. You have to be careful not to be suckered into holding onto something just because you held it. You had that call. I think we did look at sunsetting it, and we came back. We talked to those fund managers. We looked at the sector afresh, and we did decide that not only is it good value, it's actually better value than it was. And we're happy to stick to our guns for now. But yeah, professionally, that's been a tough one. Mm. I mean, personally, probably Disney. That I bought Disney right at the sort of peak of the Disney Plus hype.
Right.
I think it would be the sort of next Netflix. And weirdly enough, the only thing that keeps that stock alive, it seems, is the parks and yeah, the Parkinson experience is part of it.
Yeah. So have you got out or are you still in?
No, I think I still hold it. I think I still hold it.
It could turn.
Yeah, well, it makes it easier when I pay that Disney Plus subscription to know that 0.001 pence is coming back around to me. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's important. Well, that's great. Super interesting stuff. A nice question to close with.
Sure.
Outside of investing, what do you do with your free time?
That's a good question.
I do have free time.
I mean, I help my fiance with her business. So she's launched a babysitting platform that is sort of like Uber for childcare, which I helped her with in the early days and still support her with. And that sucks up a lot of my free time. Mm. She's the day-to-day and the brains behind it, but I do help contribute where I can. And I find that great fun. That sort of scratches an entrepreneurial itch for me. But it's a bit, I wouldn't call that a hobby. And I guess it actually, if anything, diminishes my free time.
Right.
Yes. So I guess the kind of a lame answer, you know, I like fitness. I used to be a rower. My brother is still a rower. I keep fit, probably in the vain hope that maybe one day he'll want to hop in a boat with me and drag me across the finish line. So yeah.
Well, that sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining the Advice Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
But today it is VE Day. The boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.